Hey folks, how's it going? This is Nikhil Arora and I have with me Mr. Sharad Tupran. How's it going, Sharad?
It's good. Can't complain. Another week, another podcast.
Yes.
This is the best part of the week, the one that I look forward to the most.
Really, man? I thought like we generally have such good time.
This trumps everything.
Okay.
No pun intended, but yeah.
Cool. Speaking of Trump, Mr. Bloomberg. He just came in as one of the Democratic probables for presidency. What's your thoughts on that? I have a feeling you are positive on that entire event, are you?
Yeah, anyone who sends timely, profound financial services data,
right,
makes a living out of it, and then runs for president, I'll support. You'll have my, I'm just kidding. But I mean, yeah, it's a Democrat ticket, right? We'll see. He's flip-flopped from Republican to Democrat in the past, but I like the product. I don't have any more insights on how his governance is.
He was mayor of New York for two terms, right?
Yeah. But Bloomberg Terminal and charting and tools and whatnot, I think we've extensively used.
Yeah.
So the terminal, I'm a big fan of. The guy behind it, I'm sure if he can, it's a different thing to create a financial services company from running the country, but let's see.
Is it very different? I don't know. I mean, no, I think he's probably, I was reading somewhere that when it comes to the Democratic nominees themselves, he probably will give Joe Biden a bit more competition. But yeah, in terms of his political leanings, I'm sure we don't know too much about it.
Yeah.
Even I think his stint in as a mayor, everybody was talking about how Republicans view him as not that Republican and how Democrats view him as not that Democrat.
Yeah, so he's bang in center.
Yeah, he's bang in center. So I think the world wants more focus, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, money won't be an issue. Like he's what, $55 billion worth?
Yeah. I think what, ninth richest in US or
something. So, age 77.
Is it? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, now it's the era of, after Obama, I think it's the era of much older presidents.
And CEOs.
And CEOs as well. That's correct.
So, business is making an intrusion. I mean, we had lawyers earlier.
Now, yes. Now,
sort of business people are coming into it. So, that's an interesting debate, right? Well, we used to always discuss, would lawyers make better presidents or would, let's call it, investment bankers or CEOs, business community.
So Obama was a lawyer.
He was a lawyer.
Right.
Trump and was obviously a business guy.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, the arguments on either side, right? I mean, people say that business folks understand how to run a company.
Right.
They understand P&L. At the end of the day, you just expand it. Well, and it becomes a country. So you
I think Trump has that philosophy, right?
Yeah.
Everything. But that's the thing, right? You need to have that balance as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I don't know what the answer is, but I do think that lawyers bring that kind of socio-economic angle to their entire way that they function, because that's pretty important to the way they work.
Yeah.
Guys in business, they basically just want to,
they
want to stick to what they're doing, do it well, and scale up.
Yeah.
Which probably always doesn't translate well in every domain of governance.
Yeah. One thing I'm certain is through this campaign, I think we can expect slick charts and graphs.
Yeah, slick charts and graphs. And already I was, I read that in the first week, the guy has spent $30 million.
Yeah.
In
ads.
Yeah, in ads.
Yeah.
So this is not even like, he's not even nominated yet.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, maybe that's his way of, you know, spending his retirement savings. I mean, that's his retirement plan.
He's probably
taking the biggest long position ever.
Yeah.
On his country, right?
Yeah.
By doing that.
He's part of that club also, right? Where you give away half your, if you're a billionaire, you give away half your wealth. I don't have wealth.
Yes.
I don't know what that club is called.
Yes.
Or something, yeah.
The giving club or something.
Something like that, yeah.
And, well, before we go ahead, obviously, everyone do subscribe to our podcast. Sorry, I kind of took a pivot to very operational detail. But yeah, do subscribe to our podcast. We are streaming on pretty much any podcast app that you like. It kind of goes to RSS feeds on, I don't know, 15 or 20 of them. So, you know, Spotify, Deezer, Apple Podcasts, Google. Do search for Transfin Podcast and subscribe to our channel so that you get two episodes a week now. Both a mix of 15 minutes short conversations, Adda, and our series of long shots. So with that behind us, how did, like, you know, just to kind of move towards our next topic of discussion, how did you come to work?
I Ubered it today.
Surprise.
Yeah. I tend to, it's funny, parking is such a problem. I tend to Uber in days where I might have to leave earlier.
Right.
So it's just flexibility that I have. Because if I drive my own car, then have to park it in a way which is time dependent, because right. usually it's fine. So anyway,
but is that the reason why we are talking about Uber today?
No, the reason is something very different. That maybe we'll have more predictability and we'll have more clarity on what our next Uber bill will be like.
Yeah.
Because there might be some external intervention by the government.
You mean you're talking of obviously the recent discussion around price caps.
Yeah, and obviously we keep saying Uber, but we mean Uber and Ola and ride hailing as such. But it's I think the couple of things that are coming out. One is the central government is sort of suggesting that they'll get rid of the sort of average 20% cut that the driver makes and they, the platform makes.
Right.
They want to reduce it to 10%.
So 20% is not a cap, it's the average.
It's the average. And now the government is saying they want to put a cap of around 10%.
Okay.
Which obviously, I mean, the direct implication is, i.e. driver makes more and Uber makes less.
Right.
How much, how it, you know, flows through the customer, I don't know. Maybe that's a guess. But it's interesting that there are some external regulatory environment. I don't know if this has been done in other countries. I don't know. I mean, what your thoughts are. I mean, there are a bunch of other things that the government is talking about, right? State governments might be able to put on a tax. They're talking about capping surge pricing. So, I mean, it's just intervention. What do you think about it?
I don't know. So, I just kind of opened the ET story on this.
Yeah.
I think, one point is obviously there is a talk of a cap on the commission that Uber gets to 10%, as you mentioned. And they're also saying that state governments, if they choose to, could also levy a charge on the aggregator's earnings, which is, I guess, on top of this.
Yeah.
So reduced earnings for Uber and then Uber and Ola, and then a levy on top.
Correct.
From state governments. And so these are draft rules, and they have kind of been sent for public feedback.
Yeah.
So they're not yet.
Not yet.
Yeah. And the third is on surge pricing. There is, I think, some sort of a cap which is being spoken of there as well. I read that no more than 10% of daily rides would be subject to surge pricing. So, I mean, my view on this, I think, I mean, it's only about time before ride-hailing companies would end up getting more and more regulated.
Yeah.
I think every country has its own way of doing that.
Yeah.
In India, it's mostly around pricing at the moment. It seems. I think in other geographies, especially in the Western world, the focus has been slightly different, because wasn't it only this week when London also banned Uber for a second time?
Yeah.
That was a completely different reason.
Correct.
That was
yeah.
more for, you know,
safety.
For unauthorized people ending up getting a license to drive an Uber cab. So they were kind of trying to, they were basically annoyed because of increasing probability of fraud. Whereas in India, it's mostly around pricing.
Yeah.
What the customer faces. So, you know, it's about time that was in the coming. I think in California, they are putting in rules to make sure that Uber drivers are no longer treated as contractors. They're actually treated as employees, which means they will get minimum wage.
Yeah, I read that as well. And that's such a interesting discussion, because it's so unique. Like, there's so many things where arguments can be made on either side. Like, if you are employed, like, I mean, Uber drivers can work at will, right? They can come in, they can take as many unpaid leaves, they can work whenever they want, they can start whenever they want, they can end whenever they want. If it's a job, like, no, I don't know of any other job which has that. Like, there is no mandated number of required days that you want to work, no hours. So there are things which give a very contractual feel to it. But at the same time, there are things to it which feel a very employee subordinate relationship kind of, you know, employee organization level. It's a very blurry line. I don't know which way.
I think when they were not that big, the first version held true.
Yeah.
But now I think they have scaled up at to such an extent where, I mean, I think most drivers who are on Uber or Ola, they pretty much function like employees, right? They're driving, 10 to 12 hours a day, even more.
Yeah.
Because I think the economics has made it sure that they do function like employees.
Yeah.
So, it's also a function of scale.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's obviously very interesting. And the surge thing is very interesting for me, because I know a lot of Uber drivers, when I chat with them, they operate their lifestyles around surge as well.
Right.
They know that they get good, they say, like, we get good rates on Friday evenings, we get excellent rates on Saturday evenings, we get excellent rates Saturday evenings in South Delhi near this area.
Okay.
So they sort of understand, they try to gamify, they understand where to go where.
Mm.
So they model their lifestyles as well, that they say, like, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I work in during the day. Friday, Saturday, I work during the night. Like, they've all sort of addressed it. And they've found these hacks. Like, we get good surges at this hour from at this place. If we don't get a ride, we go to the airport. They've just modeled it around surging as well. So I see where that surging element is being addressed. But I don't know. It's just for me, like, you know, I like corporates to have that kind of supply demand flexibility to devise it. But I don't know. Maybe there is something in here.
But at the moment, I think even when you look at driver incentives, they are, I mean, it's not like Uber makes X and driver gets a share of X at the moment, right? It's more about a daily revenue target that they hit. And if they hit that and they perform more than that, they get additional incentive, right? So, I mean, it's not a one-to-one correlation at the moment, right? There is like, I guess there is a bit of discounting going on. Maybe it's going down now.
Yeah.
But historically, I recall that.
Yeah, there are multiple incentives. There are so many things up there. So that's why they say an average, right? That's why they say an average 20%.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you get more, sometimes you get less. If you cover this, there's star ratings.
Because I think 2 years back, I remember 2 or 3 years back, I think initially, I think they had a thing that, okay, you have to drive X kilometers every day. Then they moved it to, you have to actually get rides worth X every day.
Yeah.
And the more you kind of, you know, the quicker do you get that target, or the higher that you exceed that target, your incentive is correlated to that.
That's
And now I guess star ratings, or you drive customer feedback.
Yeah, that also, those are all inbuilt, number of rides in a day.
Right.
All these things, and they get, so it's very incentive based.
But like, do you think, I mean, you kind of use, I think these services
once or twice a week for sure.
Do you see some sort of a like reduction in driver morale? Like, I remember there was a time when drivers were all super happy. Right? But I sense that over time, I mean, like any typical platform, I think the incentives are going down.
Yeah, incentives are going down. And also they say, one thing they always say is that there's just way too many cars on the road now.
Yeah.
So pricing pressure has crept in.
Right.
There's just way too many people willing to drive.
Right.
So that they say, like earlier, there were not too many people and incentives were higher. They used to get paid way more. Right. And now it's sort of dwindled away.
I mean, Uber is going through a major cost-cutting exercise globally, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of
guess
shows.
Guess how the stock is, like, what's the stock at since it IPO'd? How much do you think it's
actually around? I might know this. I mean, it's, I think roughly around 25-30%
down,
34%
down. Yeah. And Lyft also is down 30%.
Right.
So it's like a more ride-hailing business narrative rather than just operational brilliance or operational choppiness, right?
Right.
And with, you talked about London, like, that's a big market. Outside US for Uber, the next biggest market is UK, London.
Right.
And if you're running into headwinds there, who knows? And with the London issue, it's completely different, right? In terms of driver identification was at the center of it, right?
I mean, London is a very different taxi market in general. I mean, full disclosure, I lived there for 5 years, never used an Uber, even once.
But depends also on when you lived there.
I mean, I was there till 2016.
And Uber was there, right?
Uber was there.
Yeah.
I mean, Uber was there for almost like one and a half, 2 years
while
I was there. Never used it because I mean, would always prefer to use public transport.
Yeah.
And B, like, a taxi was always like the option of last resort. It was like, you know, if it's too late at night or, you know, one doesn't feel safe or one is too drunk or whatever, you know, those kind of very, those were pretty much the reasons why one would use a taxi. And I would actually prefer to use the black cab.
Yeah.
And in London, it's funny because the black cab drivers, I mean, they hate Uber guys.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Because I think the black cab drivers, they have this, I think, 2-year or 3-year process after which they get a license.
Mm-hmm.
And they're supposed to remember every street corner, and they're not supposed to use navigation.
Mm-hmm.
And you literally tell them, I want to go to X street, and they just like hit the gas and they you know, take you there in the shortest possible time. And in the test, that's how it works. They actually ask them, how do you go to this place?
Awesome.
And they're supposed to like literally, you know, verbalize the directions.
Yeah.
And it was like a typical case of how automation just screwed up their entire, you know, livelihood.
Yeah.
And they're pretty proud of how they ended up being black cab drivers.
Mm.
And they were like, this is a privilege. Not everyone has a right to do that. And then one fine day, an aggregator like Uber comes in, and any Tom, Dick and Harry who has a car can actually, you know, start hailing rides.
Yeah.
So so it was a very saturated, very competitive taxi market, even when I think Uber entered.
Yeah.
And I think they managed to disrupt it.
Yeah.
And yeah, now they are, I mean, but it's the second time that their license got cancelled. So I guess this can be turned back.
Yeah.
Right.
And Ola is still there, right? In London?
I kind of was reading that Ola, I think, is growing fast in the UK. But what they have done slightly differently from Uber is that they have tied up with the black cab drivers.
Yeah.
Like, they kind of went to them first. So they kind of just become an aggregator for the black cap guys. So I think that way they kind of bypassed any kind of a union, I would say pushback. Because I recall when I was there, there were two or three days when the black caps were on strike.
Yeah, yeah.
And the entire city, like you could see that the sheer number of cars on the street had gone up. And, you know, there were traffic jams and public transport was getting blocked. And that's when you realize that, you know...
how integral they are.
And then there were one or two days when the tube went on a strike, the metro. And that was even a bigger problem. Yeah. So, I think... But, you know, the interesting thing here is that how I often feel that when it comes to regulate... Like, everybody knew that the regulatory backlash against Uber and Ola were coming.
Yeah.
But the way... that they have transpired in a developing country like India versus the way they have transpired in the developed world, it's pretty different. There, the focus has been much more on processes and governance and safety and security. Here, the focus has been on price.
Correct, yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know what's the right answer.
Yeah, I was reading like London, but mainstream newspaper, they were saying that there were 14,000 trips in London where the unlicensed drivers pretended to be real Uber drivers.
Right.
And that was the crux of it, right? There's 14,000 trips like that.
Mm.
I've not heard that narrative here. And I know that there are a lot of...
A lot of fake drivers?
In the sense that the profile that shows up on your Uber app does not always match the guy who's actually behind the wheel.
Right.
It happens. And when you ask them as well, and I've asked them, and I generally still take it, I'll ask them and they'll say like, oh, it's my brother, we share it, or they'll say very openly that it's my brother, or oh, it's my contractor, he has 10 such cars, so we just use it. They're very open about it. Some say that I do it in the day and my brother does it in the night. So
I guess it's an intermediated, it's more intermediated in India, right?
Yeah.
I mean, here I think you will probably have a few guys who own the cars, but there'll be many guys who actually work for a contractor.
Correct.
Or for a third party.
Yeah.
I mean, in India, like, you know, there's no concept of one person, one device, right? Everything is shared.
Yeah.
I mean, no one on Netflix and Hotstar and everywhere, you know, you get those family plans, right?
Yeah.
I don't think we have that kind of a
mindset.
Like, it's not that individualistic yet.
Yet.
Yeah. So, interesting.
But what is individual and not shareable is a DMAT account.
Yes. yes, it is pan-linked, I guess, so far. And PAN is now Aadhaar linked.
Yeah.
And Aadhaar is unique. So it has to be unique. Yeah.
So if you, we're just trying to pivot towards our next topic.
Yes.
But if you...
This season, we are too lazy about our pivots. Yeah. This season, we just like explain our pivots from one topic to another.
Yeah.
But I think our users have already, listeners spotted have already seen through it.
Yeah.
I think you are about to kick off the discussion on Mr. Carvey.
Yeah. Yeah. And...
not Mr. Carvey. Carvey... Share broken.
Default Carvey,
yeah. So, what's the story?
A fraud by a brokerage company. And, and the reason we...
The single biggest fraud. Like, I mean, we were already kind of short of frauds, right? So,
it's a rare occurrence in the Indian ecosystem.
Quote unquote.
Especially because our leaders are very, very attentive in the assembly.
In detecting that. So, stockbroking, how's it work, you know? I guess it's an intermediary, right? I mean, if you tomorrow want to buy shares... You have to go through a guy.
Yeah.
So it's like real estate. It's a middleman.
Yeah.
And Carvey is one of the biggest middlemen, I think, when it comes to stockbroking.
Yeah.
Right? And what I understand is that they obviously take a power of attorney over the client shares because
Correct.
They execute on behalf of the clients, right? You call a guy or you push something on the app and someone actually executes that trade.
Yeah.
So they have a full power of attorney on the custody of the shares. But what they ended up doing was they used the same shares, they pledged them to raise financing for another part of their business.
Yeah, which is so brutally wrong. Like, I mean, it's my shares, my money, which is being used as, let's call it collateral to do some other business activity.
Yeah.
Even if it, and you know, it's very clear, like, I mean, what they raised 600 crores by pledging stock shares worth 2,000 crores, I think.
Yeah.
And so that's 2,000 crores worth of clients' money, which was used without my consent, without actually being applicable for that purpose.
The good thing is they were very prudent in borrowing, you know, they just raised 600 on a 2,000 crore, I mean, asset. So, you know, look at the bright side here.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. Maintain the debt to equity ratio intact.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, I mean, they essentially, whatever you and I own, or let's say people own and our shares are holdings which are there sitting on the brokerage.
Yeah.
They use that illegally to raise more capital and show them that it's their own funds, right?
What can go wrong there? I mean, just I know what can go wrong there, but I mean, just for the benefit of our listeners, if suppose tomorrow
they go bust, and well, the Investor Protection Act says that one person can get up to 25 lakhs per person. But right. But if it's bust, then you can't even do that.
So the idea is, like, let's say you bought shares in of India's largest unicorn, Reliance Industries.
Yes, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You bought their shares through Karvi.
Yeah.
Karvi has power of attorney on those shares.
Yeah.
Karvi wanted to raise some money.
Yeah.
It pledged those shares with some other person.
Pretending as if they're theirs.
As if it's theirs.
Yeah.
And they raise the money.
Yeah.
Right? And say tomorrow the person comes for payback.
Yeah.
And Karvi, let's assume, doesn't have that yeah. much liquidity.
Yeah.
You know, say things have gone bad like they have right
yeah.
now.
They'll lose parallels to bad loans as well, right? In yeah. this, and we'll talk about that in a bit, but yeah.
Yeah, so then what will happen? Basically, the guy that they have borrowed with, they're going to be like, okay, you cannot pay me back.
Yeah.
Give me the shares.
Yeah.
And then the question comes, oh, they are not your shares in the first place.
Yeah.
They are shares of Mr. Sharad.
Yeah.
And that's how things will go wrong very quickly, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly what yeah. exactly how, right? And these guys are doing prop trading. Prop trading, proprietary trading is essentially that when a brokerage makes trades on their own books on with their own money. But in this case, their own money mm-hmm. is not really their own money. It's their client's shares or holdings or positions, right?
Yeah.
So you're essentially betting on someone without their consent. And then if you go bust, then, well, you go bust.
Yeah.
So, and I think you were talking about, when we were discussing, like, about how, what the regulatory angle towards it is. Like, why did it miss? Like, how did it not catch the eye? Or there are other discount brokerages that are now in the radar as well?
Yeah, so I think SEBI spotted this. And this apparently these transactions happened in between 2017 to 19. So it's taken them some time to spot it.
Yeah.
Right. And then they kind of basically they started asking the exchanges, in this case NSE and BSE, that what the hell? Why weren't you able to? So the exchanges have the onus of doing the diligence of the brokers.
Yeah.
That they are actually dealing with. Right. So obviously there was a lapse at the exchange level. But I mean, that's the thing. Like most of the reporting on this entire incident has been on the facts of the matter, that how the fraud transpired,
yeah,
or what exactly the fraud is. But I'm not seeing a lot on how did this even happen, like
yeah.
how come they were able to pledge someone else's. It's like I am pledging your property to raise money.
Yeah,
how the hell did this kind of
yeah.
get missed?
Yeah,
so this shows that there are, you know, big governance lapses here.
Yeah,
right, which got missed. Which kind of also links back to the point on Uber and Ola, right? I mean, the governance is everything, right? And somehow the focus has in our country has been secondary on it. The focus is more on the low hanging fruit like price caps and
whatever makes sense from a populist.
I think so. Narrative. I mean, that's what it kind of comes out as.
I hear
right?
you. Yeah.
And so you know, I'm not sure how the mechanics of it went. Obviously, there were guys who must be knowing about it and they ignored it, or
yeah.
you know, the systems were just not sophisticated enough to. I mean, I'm assuming that they must be doing fast transactions in bulk. So obviously there's something missing in the IT systems
yeah.
where, you know, these things didn't get red flagged at the right stage.
Yeah.
And or they were able to manage it one way or the other.
Yeah.
That's where now the probe is all actually on all the exchanges.
Yeah.
In addition to the brokers, that what's going on, guys.
Yeah. And it's fairly complicated once you get into it. So we'll save that. I mean, it's something that even I need to read up on, but sort of how, you know, margin funding and where those, how that power of attorney works and where those shares are there and like how it transfers through your DMAT account to the brokerage, to the exchange.
Yeah.
Those there are technical intricacies there,
yeah.
where there's enough room for guys like the discount brokerage who can.
I mean, the thing is that the DMAT account is technically with the broker.
With the broker, which is, you're concentrating your risk, right? I mean, it's, I guess, I don't know what makes sense, but that is one of the advantages that people have when it comes to not just ease of trading, but on the flip side, also for a brokerage to sort of get maximum visibility and control over something that's not there.
Yeah. I mean, it's something similar happened in the case of, I mean, not similar, but like a similar lapse, I would say, with this entire story on Fortis.
Yeah.
In Fortis's case as well, like one of the allegations was that like the Singh brothers, the promoters, they actually, like this was the allegation of this Gurinder Singh Dhillon, who's the uncle was the guy who heads that Satsang sect.
Yeah.
So he alleged that these guys, the brothers, came to me, said that, okay, here's some money. Why don't you subscribe to a rights issue? And, you know, this is like some sort of verbal understanding between us. So they were bankrolling
mm-hmm.
the purchase of shares without anything in writing.
Yeah.
Right? But all that money was white. You know, I mean, obviously, if they were, he subscribed to a rights issue, must have gone through some sort of a bank account. So there must be some money coming in the bank account first. And the tax authorities were so prudent in spotting such things, missed it. Right? Yeah. So I think that's where this entire governance debate eventually goes to. And, you know, it's slightly distressing, man. It's kind of bums me out when you even talk about it.
Yeah.
And
do you think RBI should bail out Karvi?
RBI already is busy bailing out other people. You know?
Yeah. So what's the story there? Because that I find very interesting.
I don't think they have. I think it was some Reuters story 1 or 2 days. I think yesterday only, saying that the finance ministry wants RBI to set up a fund to buy out the stressed assets of 25 quote unquote shadow lenders, basically 25 NBFCs.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, FM is asking RBI to create a bad bank.
Yeah.
So.
And do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing? Like, I would assume, like, ring fencing all toxic assets or toxic loans, toxic underwritten assets or liabilities, whatever you want to call them, but that might be good to prevent, like, a contagion. Is that sort of, like, that's a very high level.
I mean, that's how bad banks, that's the idea behind bad banks.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, if you're a good bank, if you're a bank, you have two types of loans. You have good loans and you have bad loans.
Yeah.
And what the bad bank does is you ring fence the bad loans, move it to another entity,
mm-hmm.
right? So that now the bank becomes a good bank.
Yeah.
Right? And the investors get comfort. It's a listed company. So, you know, and then the toxic stuff is being hived off. And they're just assets which are put in runoff. It's been done before. It's not new. I mean, it was pretty common in Europe, in the US, post 2007-8.
Yeah.
We have spoken about UKFI in the United Kingdom. It was a bad bank. Sareb in Spain, bad bank.
Mm.
So it's not something very breathtakingly fresh.
Mm.
But the way the model can work is that, say I'm DHFL, right?
Yeah.
I mean, DHFL probably is not the best example because then this has already happened.
Yeah.
But say I'm State Bank of India, right? And I have a ton of bad assets. So what I'll do is the government will actually create a new SPV or a new banking entity and move the bad assets away from State Bank of India into that.
Mm-hmm.
But then the idea is that, you know, some hedge fund or private equity firm, like an AIF, quote unquote, alternate investment fund would come in. They're going to buy those distressed assets at a discount.
Yeah.
They're going to turn them around, sell them off again, and then make a gain out of it. And that's one way to make sure that those toxic assets turn out to be okay in the end. But the problem that comes is that you need, number one, for those private equity and hedge funds to, you know, grab onto these assets in the first place. And the second is that you need to turn them around. And I think in both those departments, things are not looking very good in India.
Yeah.
Because, say you have bad home loans or bad real estate loans, then you need a real estate operator to turn them around. And most real estate operators themselves are distressed.
Yeah.
So then it kind of goes into a cyclical thing. So
can an overseas operator probably capitalize on this?
I think they've done that, right? I mean, like Blackstone did that.
Yeah.
Blackstone did that with Embassy, right? They kind of took away a lot of the bad assets of DHFL. But Embassy is maybe an exception to the rule because they are, number one, not distressed. And number two, obviously, they have some good, solid understanding with Blackstone.
Yeah.
So they're working together. But I think that's not that doesn't happen very frequently. I was reading somewhere that there was a time when I think State Bank of India were buying off bad loans.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it very funny that why is one banking institution buying off bad loans from another? The NPA problem is something very systemic now. That has been established, right? It started with scheduled commercial banks. Then it moved to NBFCs. Now even Mudra loans, I think 69% NPAs were up in a year.
Yeah.
I mean, the RBI deputy governor has been warning about it now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it just again shows that the governance, there were major governance lapses over years. And all that, that toxic cocktail is now for everyone to see.
Yeah.
It's going to take a lot of time for it to kind of, recover.
So, what do you think the government and the RBI sort of going, like a government wants the RBI to sort of bail out effectively, I guess? And the RBI obviously saying that no, it's not our business to bail these guys out. Like, what are your views on that?
I mean, my personal view is few banks should be allowed to fail.
Okay, I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think few banks should be allowed to fail. Depositors will be hit, but I think unless that happens, that entire moral hazard of being bailed out won't disappear. So the bankers need to lose jobs who have not kind of committed to governance norms, and the pain needs to be felt. I mean, but that's a very, very market-centric view. So I don't think it's going to be very popular. I remember, like, I mean, when the PMC crisis was going on and they were like depositors who were, you know, crying on national television.
Yeah.
I mean, and I was talking to a few people, like, I did not have any sympathy for them, but I was like the most unpopular person in the room when I was saying that. But I think bank runs have happened globally. This is probably the first time in India bank runs are happening.
Yeah.
So I know it's not the depositors' fault. Maybe government should now start charging levies to ensure that the, you know, FDIC or the depositor insurance plan is more than 10 lakhs, so, which is nothing. And then they need to strictly crack down on, you know, bad lending practices. They need to change management practices. They need to change boards. I remember Bank Bureau Board was created to regulate bank governance.
Yeah.
It has not done anything. So those systemic issues should be targeted rather than price actions.
Yeah.
Right? Rather than kind of, you know, putting band-aid solutions on everything.
Yeah.
Right? But yeah, I mean, that's my opinion. So
yeah, no, unpopular, but it, like, you know, in the long
run, I won't last in politics, obviously, if I say things like that, right?
Yeah, no, so, I mean, it's different. Look, but I see the logic of it, right? I mean, it sets a precedent, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes you need. I agree. It's such a difficult one to address, right? Because pain is being felt by someone who's no fault. So from a moralistic ground standpoint, you can sympathize with that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if the long-term sustainability and respecting credit, that philosophy only comes when you get penalized for disrespecting credit.
Yeah.
And that has, like you said, pain has to be felt. It's just unfortunate. Who feels the pain? That's a highly, I mean, something that needs to be discussed, but someone needs to feel the pain. It can't be just every taxpayer and helping the government to bail them out. Like, it, then it sets a precedent. But yeah.
I mean, when it comes to bailouts, obviously, when you look at systemically important banking institutions, you have to bite the bullet there.
We saw that, right? In USA, in 07, 08. Yeah.
I mean, even in India, like when you look at ILNFS, that was a systemically important institution, right? So they had to bail it out. But like PMC, why bail it out? I mean, sorry. I mean, that just doesn't work.
Yeah.
DHFL, okay, got hived off. PE fund came, bought it out, fine.
Turn it around, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's an okay story. Yeah, promoter should be penalized. They should be sent to jail if there's a criminal, you know, intent which has been proven. Sure. I mean, that rule of law, but the pain should be felt.
Yeah.
Right? That goes with any kind of a corporate scenario, right?
I agree, yeah.
Why bail out? Why bail out Jet Airways?
Yeah.
Why, you know, I mean, why to even think of that?
Yeah.
So, it is what it is. And so, we kind of, I must say, depressing podcast, my friend.
Touched on very cynical and negative touch points today. But pain needs to be felt at times.
Pain needs to be felt. So we ensured that our listeners also felt some pain, I guess, today due to no fault of theirs. But I mean, I hope they found it interesting nevertheless.
Yeah.
And I promise in next week, we'll probably make it slightly more upbeat, you know, in the overall grand scheme of things.
We're in December now. Let's focus on somewhat positive stuff.
Yes, we should. We should. Yeah, with that, I think welcome all our listeners to again subscribe to our podcast, to give your comments, give your feedback. Do send us topics that you want us to cover. That would really help us a lot in terms of, you know, just making this content richer for everyone. Another shout out, as you know, we run in Transfin, we are obviously hiring all the time. So we are currently looking for a full stack developer as well as a digital marketer. Happy to drop in the job descriptions in the description field in the podcast. So do give us a shout if you know someone who might be interested in those roles. And we'll be happy to take that forward. And yeah, with that, thank you so much. Have a great week ahead. This is Nikhil Arora.
And this is Sharad Tupran.
Signing off.